This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So you can see large black spots on what used to be pure crystalline blue-green waters. Everything has turned black. The white sandy beaches are now all black. People are heartbroken.
That's journalist Nad Sivaraman in Port Louis, Mauritius, describing the aftermath of an oil spill in the Indian Ocean nation. Details coming up. Also, police fire tear gas today to disperse protesters in Mali's capital, Bamako. And Tanzanian rights activists and media are accusing the government of limiting press freedom. Those stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Cleanup crews are scrambling to contain a massive oil spill off the Indian Ocean nation of Mauritius. The Japanese-owned ship Wakashio hit a reef in late July, leaking tons of oil into the sea on the southeast of the island. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to journalist Nad Sivaraman, director of publication for La Centennial Media Group in Port Louis, Mauritius.
Since yesterday, there's a serious risk of a ship being torn into two pieces because it's really in bad shape. So everything has been done to pump out the oil from the Wakashio. Right now, at the time I'm talking to you, we still have 300 tons of heavy oil on board. But that's a good progress because from the get-go, they had like 2,500 tons, metric tons of fuel on board. 1,000 went, as we know, sadly, into the ocean. They think they will finish the pumping of all the oil by tonight. So the risk that there will be more pollution is going down.
As you've said, there's already a huge amount of oil that has leaked into the ocean around southeast Mauritius. What does that look like? What's the impact of that so far on the environments there?
So you can see large black spots on what used to be pure crystalline blue-green waters. You know, the southeast of Mauritius, it's like postcard. It's known for its wildlife, but also for the water, the pristine waters and the white sandy beaches. So nowadays, people have said it's no more Blue Bay. Blue Bay is next to where the Wakashio went onto the reef. So it's Black Bay. Everything has turned black. The white sandy beaches are now all black. So it's a very, very sad picture. People are heartbroken, because we have never seen Mauritius in such a state before. And people have a lot of questions. They are angry, and they are asking themselves, how come such a big ship came on our shore, into our territorial waters, without us being in the know? No one knew this ship was coming on us. No radar, the police did not know. It's only after the crash on the 25th of July at 1925, that local people started to share the pictures, that the local authorities got aware of the situation and started to, you know, get their acts together.
And what is the response looking like, both from the regular people and from the government?
People are trying to help, you know, because the government said we don't have enough equipment. This saw a spontaneous movement from citizens from all walks of life trying to come and collect the fuel which is coming, which is being washed on our shores. So it's more like a bottom-up movement that we are witnessing in Mauritius. Citizens have come to realize that government is not equipped government did not do things in a proper fashion, because it's only 12 days after the wreckage that they are doing the salvage operation. So people are trying to help with their own little means. They are building booms with straws, with plastic bottles. They are collecting, you know, the heavy oil with small buckets. And, you know, it's a very sad scene.
That was journalist Nad Sivaraman, a director of publication for La Centennelle Media Group in Port Louis, Mauritius. He was speaking to my VOA colleague, Jason Patinkin. Police fired tear gas today to disperse protesters in Mali's capital, Bamako, a day after thousands took to the streets to demand the president step down. Mali's opposition accuses President Ibrahim Boubacar's government of corruption and nepotism amid widespread insecurity. Journalist Bram Posthumus in Bamako has more.
Yesterday afternoon's sit-in demonstration that was organized by the opposition under the spiritual guidance of Imam Mahmoud Diko, went ahead peacefully. And as it was a sit-in, people decided to stay throughout the night until early in the morning. Eyewitnesses I spoke to told me that the atmosphere was very good, with tea and bread being brought around among the demonstrators so that nothing untoward can be reported from that night. Early this morning, people say between 6 and 7 a.m., police came and dispersed the crowds who had stayed throughout the night using tear gas. And from then on, word came from Imam Diko, who was consulted about the turn of events, and he said that everybody should leave the area and come to the opposition headquarters, which is on the other side of the Niger River in downtown Bamako, where a statement is expected later this afternoon. I've also been told that the demonstrations are set to be repeated every Tuesday in the afternoon at 2 o'clock p.m. local time until President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and his government have left the scene. This is Bram Posthumus in Bamako.
Tanzanian right activists and media are accusing the government of limiting press freedom after the release of new content regulations. The rules prohibit local media from broadcasting foreign media content without government permission and require local journalists working with foreign reporters to have a government minder. Rights groups say this is part of a series of measures by the Tanzanian authorities to limit press freedom. In an interview with the BBC, Tanzanian Information Minister Harrison Mwakembe says the government didn't ban foreign content in the local media. He said it placed procedures that will enable the government to know which stations partner with foreign media to air their programs in the country. In response to the new regulations, Acting VOA Director Elez Bibraj said, for 58 years, the VOA Swahili service has broadcast news and information to citizens in East Africa. This is the first time Tanzania or any East African government has made such a brazen movement to restrict press freedom. If this is not reversed, the Tanzanian people will be denied important information just as they prepare to go to the polls in October. In the Gambia, dozens of villagers have been left critically injured and others arrested amid communal land dispute violence. The incident happened Tuesday in Niamina Sambanga village. Reporter Panderambai in Raleigh, North Carolina has the story.
A simmering land dispute between members of the Fulani and Mandinga communities in the Gambia devolved into violence Tuesday. Villager Kumbaso's house was among the homes set ablaze at Nyamina Sambang village, about 242 kilometers east of the capital, Banjul. She says all her belongings have been burned to ashes. Food items such as rice, cooking oil, clothes, money, and other valuables had perished when her home was set ablaze during land dispute communal violence. Kumba and her family are now homeless, living with other relatives in the village. This is not the first time that Kumba Sow had been attacked. She says she suffered a similar fate last year when violence erupted in the community. She was sitting home minding her business when she got attacked and injured on the head. She says she was never part of the land dispute violence and couldn't understand why she should be assaulted. An 80-year-old man, local shop owner, was also attacked during the incident, villagers said. He was at his shop when an angry mob accosted him. He was beaten by his attackers. The attackers were armed with traditional weapons. Superintendent Lamin Jai is the spokesman for the Gambia Police Force.
What we understand for now, the dispute started with one individual that was passing with his donkey in the other person's farmlands, and so an altercation ensued between the two of them, and this degenerated into an actual violence between the two communities. So far for now, the police are able to gather the fact that several people were involved in this dispute, and about 21 people have sustained various degrees of injuries.
Njai says Cam returned to the village with numerous arrests made.
And also we understand that about 3 houses were also burned in the process during the dispute. So far, the police have deployed officers to this place and to maintain the peace. And as of now, they are able to restore calm. And not only that also, but the police have also opened an investigation into the situation so that it is going to be investigated.
Bakari Jallo hails from the region where the incident happened. He spoke to VOA from Banjul.
The communal land dispute in Nyanya Samban is devastating. It is very serious, and then it is causing a lot of hazard in the area, which is affecting almost everybody. People who have been living together in harmony as one family for over decades of years, over centuries, have today turned out into rivals.
The disputed land has been a subject of litigation in the courts. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Following a series of widespread reports of the humanitarian and economic crisis in Zimbabwe, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa sent an envoy to Harare this week. The visit brought hope to some Zimbabweans who are eager to see the country take a turn for the better. Reporter Kudzai Zinawashi has more from Harare.
Independent political analyst Vivid Gwede is among the Zimbabweans who are optimistic about the South African outreach.
The coming of President Ramaphosa's envoys to Zimbabwe is a positive step if that is going to lead to concrete discussions about how to solve the problems that are prevailing in the country.
Dr. Sydney Mafamadi is among those sent by South Africa President Ramaphosa. He spoke with the media after meeting President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his team in Harare.
We were listening to the reading of the situation and what is being done, or the intentions to do what extra things and so on. And I know you will not ask us to report to our president through the media. We will be reporting to the president, who will then interact with the public in due course.
Ramaphosa sent the envoys after a growing campaign in South Africa for the government to take a stand on what many say is a worsening human rights situation in Zimbabwe. The Zimbabwe government recently suppressed planned anti-corruption protests and has detained scores of government critics, opposition politicians, and journalists in recent weeks. The country's economy is nearing collapse, with inflation about 700% annually, shortages of currency, food and medicine, and the growing effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The South Africa's president said the envoys would engage the government of Zimbabwe and relevant stakeholders to identify possible ways in which South Africa can assist Zimbabwe. Gwede says, though, that the envoy's role was particularly restricted on this visit.
However, we should also know that the role of envoys is limited, and it has further even been limited by the fact that they just met President Emmerson Mnangagwa alone without talking to other players in the Zimbabwean space, including the opposition, the civil society, and other groups like the Labour.
The visit was short, and the main opposition group, the MDC Alliance, said its scheduled meeting with the envoy did not materialize. Gwede adds that Zimbabweans have to be proactive in finding a solution, something that South Africa can help facilitate. Gwede says Ramaphosa is in a good standing to use his role as chairman of the African Union to help in resolving the crisis in Zimbabwe. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunavashe from Harare.
Growing numbers of healthcare workers in South Africa are suffering breakdown as the country's COVID-19 pandemic intensifies. Mental health experts say the strain of caring for sick and dying patients, while at the same time being terrified of becoming infected, is hitting many nurses and doctors. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
South Africa had a severe shortage of healthcare givers long before the coronavirus. Now that the pandemic is filling hospitals, they're under unprecedented physical and emotional pressure.
This work in South Africa, even before the COVID crisis, is already immense, already on the front line.
Zama Mbele is a clinical psychologist who counsels doctors and nurses. He explains that South Africa has some of the highest violent crime and road accident rates in the world. Diseases such as tuberculosis are rife. Healthcare workers witness this pain every day. Now, says psychiatrist Antoinette Murich, they also have to deal with a shadowy, potentially fatal illness that's been thrust upon them virtually overnight.
We've got the uncertainty of the virus itself. What we did 2 weeks ago is maybe not what we do now. So there's constant...
Murich says information about COVID-19 is changing all the time. And the fact that it's an unknown quantity is extremely stressful.
We've seen the waves of anxiety, waves of emotions. We started off with a lot of anxiety, a lot of anticipatory anxiety. Then some people, I suspect, would have hit that adrenaline spike where they just work really hard. Then it becomes irritation and frustration, and then overwhelmed. And
the National Institute for Occupational Health says about 4,000 healthcare workers in South Africa have been infected with coronavirus, and it's claimed the lives of at least 50. Mbele says doctors and nurses are going to work to stare down the barrel of a gun.
Everybody was looking to healthcare workers in a way that created this myth that healthcare workers are going to be stoic and calm and themselves are not going to panic. So again, you're doing double work. You're working to attend to what people need, though you're also working to push down your own worries and fears, which of course will come back again.
The psychologist points out that while millions of South Africans had a break from work during the country's 100-day hard lockdown, those in healthcare continue to work flat out.
So one of the things that we expect and anticipate at this point is already a level of fatigue. And that fatigue is not just because there's been work until this point. How they've been working has been incredibly stressful.
Mbele himself works at a hospital filled with COVID-19 patients, and he counsels doctors and nurses who could also be infected.
A lot of the essential workers are not just having to do the work that they're doing in hospitals, but they're also having to do the work of looking after themselves, which is a silent kind of work that can also be exhausting. It's not just that their caseload has increased and it's going to increase. It's also, in fact, that they're also themselves working on the COVID anxiety. How do you keep yourself safe? And how do you introduce...
Mirich is concerned that many healthcare workers aren't seeking help from professionals such as herself.
They're by nature less served. At this stage in the pandemic, I'm specifically encouraging people to look after themselves, because if we do not have essential workers, healthcare workers looking after themselves, we cannot look after the public.
Mbele and Murich are certain that South African nurses and doctors, like their colleagues elsewhere, are going to experience the mental impact of the pandemic for the rest of their lives. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As Somalia and the self-declared Republic of Somaliland head towards elections, conflict experts are calling on all sides not to let politics disrupt progress in recent talks. The two sides are in disagreement over the status of Somaliland, which declared independence from Mogadishu in 1991. But a landmark agreement between their leaders in June not to politicize aid and investment raised hopes of reducing occasional clashes between their troops, as Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
In June, Somali government officials led by President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo met a delegation from Somaliland led by President Musa Bihi. The meeting in Djibouti was the first time Somalia and Somaliland's presidents have met since 1991, when the Somali government collapsed and Somaliland declared its independence. Somaliland is not recognized by any country. The agreement not to politicize aid and investment was another fuss between the sides. But both Somalia and Somaliland are scheduled to have elections in coming months, and analysts suspect that will hold up any further negotiations. Omar Mahmoud is a senior analyst on Somalia at the International Crisis Group.
I think Mogadishu is going to be quite distracted over the next few months. You know, it's one, an issue to what degree can the current government engage at a deep level, given that they only have a few months remaining on this mandate. But two, it's also a capacity issue, since a lot about the election in Somalia is still up for debate in terms of the timelines, in terms of the model, in terms of a number of dynamics. So I think it'll be difficult to engage on a deeper level in the next few months.
Last month, the Somali government voted out Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre for failing to secure general election and national security. Since then, the technical team that is supposed to follow up on the Djibouti talks has not held any meetings, according to a member of the team from Mogadishu who was not authorized to speak to the media. Mahmoud says that hopefully Somalia and Somaliland can still discuss issues that can be achieved in the short term.
That's the international assistance and humanitarian aid and basically how they share that. And then also security, so security cooperation. Of course, the battle against al-Shabaab and these sorts of things. And so they've already outlined the three very specific topics, and they're supposed to have some subcommittees meeting on those. So I think they can continue on that. You know, it's basically reestablishing working relations.
However, there appears to be no change in Somalia's stance that Somaliland is not an independent country. Mogadishu's technical team on the talks is led by the Interior Minister, signaling that Somalia considers the talks an internal matter. Somaliland's team is led by the Foreign Affairs Minister, signalling that Hargeisa sees the talks as a negotiation between two states. Faisal Ali Warabe is an opposition politician in Somaliland. He says there is nothing to talk about with Somalia. The timing was not right, Warabe says. He says, we will think about engaging Somalia in the future, knowing well there is no government. He says Somalia is a divided country with five presidents and five states. Warabe adds, since we have our country, there is no war between us and they have no power over us. It was a mistake to engage them. The people of Somaliland accuse Somalia's government of committing widespread abuses against them during the government of Mohamed Siad Barre in the 1980s. Still, the two sides have agreed to continue with the engagement in hopes of finding a solution to their political and historical differences. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports. sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here.